Others have their secrets and their insights that are extremely beneficial when working land and with livestock, especially when years of experience are part of the picture. But the picture can get larger. Dr. Stefan von Vliet, originally researching kinesiological topics, has been zeroing in on agricultural and human nutrition. He brings together not only nutritional information, but the growing connection that supports farmers and ranchers and us in our lives. Our next guest today, milling for performance and flavor, Jacob Trumbull at Roaring Fork Mill in Colorado, is continuing the almost timeless tradition of stone-milled flour. They source heritage grains locally, which not only feeds the community, but strengthens it as well. I'm Robin with Cultivated Audio for November 2025. Grab your earbuds and or a shovel, and let's dig in. Stefan, tell us how your initial research brought you into supporting the regenerative agriculture movement.
So it's an interesting story because I don't really have a background in agriculture in any of my degrees. How it came about is my background is in muscle physiology and muscle biology, specifically in humans, and its relationship to sports nutrition and protein intake and how that impacts the muscle, how that grows our muscles, how that responds to exercise. And I was applying for a grant at some point, and a scientist was on that panel from USDA ARS. And I got a call from him and a colleague of him, Fred Provenza, which is actually a former professor at Utah State University. The individual at USDA, his name is Scott Kronberg. And they asked, well, we've always been excited to work with a human nutrition scientist. We do a lot of work in livestock, particularly in grass-finished systems. And do you want to partner on some grants? And that's kind of how I rolled into it. I did have an personal interest in it just because I grew up near farmlands and we'd often get our food from farmers market or get our dairy directly from the farmer. So I think subconsciously I had an interest. Yeah, I kind of rolled into it.
I love that. I feel like my whole life has been coming out of left field, so I can definitely relate. Would you say that biodiversity really is at the bottom or the start of nutrition, whether it be soil or the plants, which become the end product in our livestock?
It certainly appears so. One of the strongest predictors we have found for nutrient density in beef, but also other products like goat and bison, it seems to be biodiversity. And there's also different fields that point towards a direction. In the soil sciences, you can find that plant diversity or biodiversity typically has a beneficial effect on soil health metrics. And we also found that that is a strong predictor of animal health and also of human health. But if you kind of think about it, if let's say we have the grazing animal, a cow, if it can select from, let's say, 30, 40 different plant species, it is much better able to nourish itself than when it's, for instance, can only select from one or two plant species. And maybe the best example I can give is within humans, right? Let's say we dine at a buffet every day and we walk into the buffet and there's 50 different foods to select from, all kinds of different salads, fruits, vegetables, different meats, yogurt. We would be better able to nourish ourselves than when we walk into the buffet and there's the same three foods available every day. What do animals select? And it seems that when given the choice, and if they have familiarity with the environment, meaning that they know what the plants are, they are familiar with the plants, with the taste, the smell, that they're able to better nourish themselves. And no two animals would select the same two plants based on maybe their specific nutritional needs, or if they feel like they may have to ward off a parasite, they would select different plants and during different times of the year also and during different health stages. So it's really important that the animal is able to select it. Probably in humans, it's very important too. What we've made it hard for ourselves is talking about that cafeteria is that we have a lot of ultra-processed foods that are very tasty, but they're probably not the healthiest for us that we can select from. And that's where we run into issues, I think.
Just that kind of statement for me, send such a big signal to be wary of labels. Organic was one point, oh my gosh, if we can go organic, everything will be great. And yet organic has become very misleading without a regenerative or a sustainable factor in there. And I've heard you say that the best feedlot cattle can be actually more nutritious for us than the worst grass-fed. And by saying worst grass-fed, what we mean, I guess, or what I would mean is that grass-fed animal that had one kind of grass to eat.
Yeah, and there's maybe overgrazing indeed. And when we say worse, it doesn't mean it's like bad for your health. It's bigger picture for sure, but when we think of that and we look at the nutrient density, and this is a combination typically of phytochemicals, which yes. are antioxidants, B vitamins, fat soluble vitamins, fatty acids, so these various micronutrients, and as well as phytonutrients, we see that some feedlot samples are indeed higher in those nutrients combined than maybe some of the not so great grass-fed samples. But again, the strongest predictor in that data set was biodiversity. So if the grass-fed animals are on more biodiverse pastures, they typically have increased nutrient density. But there's also certain feedlot-finished animals. Typically, these are animals that maybe eat proportionally more hay versus corn. Maybe their finishing period, instead of 4 months, is maybe 2 months. So there's nuances in that. And they're also very interesting that there's some farmers that maybe finish their animals on pasture, but put maybe a feed bunk out where they feed some distiller grains or other grain byproducts. And they're hard to classify because they're pasture finished. The animals are on pasture, but they have access to some grain. So is that grain fed? Is that grass fed? They certainly look closer to grass fed than they do to grain fed.
Yes, of course. So are we basically looking for phytonutrient density when we're looking at health for either ourselves or animals? And does it start with looking at proteins and fats?
Well, certainly that's also important. So proteins and fats and vitamins and minerals, they're typically classified as primary nutrients, whereas the phytonutrients are classified as secondary nutrients. And that's really because 50 years ago, when these things started to get discovered, we didn't really know what phytonutrients did. But phytonutrients are things like polyphenols, flavonoids, terpenes, carotenoids, things that are typically antioxidant, anti-inflammatory. They can lower our risk of metabolic disease, so they generally improve our health, but they're not per se essential to life, meaning that if I never eat a polyphenol, I won't die. But if I never eat vitamin C, I will eventually die because I will develop scurvy, right?
Right.
But we have done a good job in solving those initial micronutrient deficiencies, partly also due to fortification of our food supply, right? Because when you strip the bran of the grain, go from whole wheat to refined, you typically strip out a lot of the B vitamins, but we fortify our food supply with them. But the phytonutrients, really, we're not getting a lot of specifically our standard American diet. And while there's multiple reasons why we have metabolic disease, one of the reasons probably is that we have such low exposure to those antioxidant and anti-inflammatory type of bioactive, these phytonutrients. At least when you put them on a cancer cell line in the lab, anti-cancer activity, they can impact our insulin-producing cells, they can impact our brain cells, maybe lower our risk of things like Alzheimer's. So really having low amounts of these in the diet, which is probably, A, due to eating a standard American diet rich in ultra-processed foods, and then the fruits and vegetables that we do eat, they have been watered down,
right?
Typically, quite literally, right? Because we selected for high protein, for high yield, and as a result, have watered down some of those other nutrients as well, which I think that's what we're observing, sort of this twofold issue.
Yes. So in saying all of that, Stefan, are those individual nutrients that are added back, do you think they're actually used very well?
Bioavailability of those can be lower depending on the nutrient. Yeah, their metabolism is slightly different. Well, I would argue that it's preferred to get your B vitamins from a whole food source as opposed to maybe a supplement or a fortified food source, is because there's probably a whole host of other cofactors within right. the whole food source that help with the metabolism. So while you may not get the classic nutrient deficiency associated with maybe pellagra or beriberi, which is thiamine, vitamin B1 and B3 deficiency, it may also not be optimal, if that makes sense.
Of course, yes. And it's interesting, isn't it, that different livestock have different qualities and nutritive values. Is that basically because of what they're eating? Obviously, mixing livestock together in the field to graze is a great idea, but you'll see a deer eating differently than a cow or a sheep. So how do you see that translating into the nutrient value?
Yeah, I mean, there's a direct relationship there. The old saying, you are what you eat, holds true in livestock as well. The nutrient density is directly related to what the animals ate. And the interesting part of that is also, now as you bring up multi-species grazing, which is a great ecological tool because sheep and goats, they eat different plants than cows do, or deer. But one of the benefits of that is indeed that you can probably produce more food per acre. And what's also very unique is that goats and sheep, they tend to eat a lot of what we consider wheat, and those wheats are actually quite rich in phytonutrients. So when you study things like goat milk or sheep milk or their meat, it's actually quite rich in these phytonutrients, and maybe explains why the flavor of those is a little bit stronger.
Goat milk is something people need to get used to when they've been drinking cow milk their whole life.
Yeah, that's right. The interesting part of that is that when we test the phytonutrients in goat's milk, which are compounds that are obtained from the plant and then become transformed within the animal, but definitely have still have a relationship to that plant. So whatever the aroma and the flavor is of that plant, it does get reflected in the milk. And we see that the phytonutrients are about four times higher in goat milk than in cow's milk. So that probably also explains why the goat milk has a stronger flavor. I'm probably a little bit biased, but I'm also a person who likes to eat 100% dark chocolate because it provides more flavor to me.
Yes, yes.
Is that I quite enjoy that flavor, and probably the reason why I'm saying I'm biased is that as a nutrition scientist, I also study the health effects. My group studies the health effects of these compounds. So knowing if it's richer in these compounds, if the dark chocolate is richer in these antioxidants, these polyphenols, then I'm also motivated to eat something that is richer in it.
Yes. And would it be correct to say that there's an almost homeopathic effect from nutrients in plants, in that we might, or a cow might, take a minuscule amount of whatever nutrient, but the amount that then shows up in the body is surprisingly more? And if that's true, is it the same in soil-to-plant relationship?
Yes, that is definitely true. What I can say with a certain degree of confidence is that within the meat and milk of cows or other animals as well, sheep, goats, we actually have a review coming out on that probably early next year. But there's a lot of medicinal compounds that are being picked up from the animal, mainly because the animal grazes plants that you and I cannot consume. So you get some unique medicinal compounds. It certainly seems that this impacts the health of the animal by having maybe antimicrobial effects or antibacterial effects, anti-inflammatory effects. What we don't know yet is how does that impact the health of us, and can we detect these compounds within our body? A little bit newer discovery that some of those medicinal compounds actually end up in the meat and milk. And similar to the relationship between the plant and the soil, things like polyphenols and flavonoids, they also result in an interaction between the plant and the soil and the microbes within the soil. So you get, again, if you can create a scenario where you can get this positive feedback loop where there's more microbial life in the soil, you have more of these phytonutrients within the plants, maybe you have more biodiversity, meaning that the plants kind of act in synergistic ways, but also compete amongst each other. It kind of rises all tides, all phytonutrient tides.
Right.
So there certainly seems to be that relationship present.
Yeah, and I found it so interesting that when a diet includes meat that's been regeneratively raised, the body takes up more nutrients from plants.
Yes, and it doesn't just happen when the meat is regeneratively raised, but in general, yes, there's definitely interesting data. It's some unidentified factors within meat, or I should say, to an extent, animal source foods in general. Certainly eggs could also come into that category.
Mm.
But that means is that, let's say you eat beef with beans, you actually get more iron and zinc uptake from the beans because of some unidentified factors. There's some hypothesis on what it may be, but these meat factors that actually can help take up more zinc and iron from plant foods. So in this case, when you're making chili, maybe it's not a question, should I use beans or beef, but perhaps it's a good idea to use both, because you get a greater uptake from the nutrients from the beans. And at the same time, plants also play a synergistic effect, whereas there's very interesting work to suggest that when meat is eaten alongside fruits and vegetables or marinades, that actually some of those compounds that may be formed through grilling or heating of the meat that are maybe considered carcinogenic or other advanced glycation end products, they're actually quite a bit reduced when you eat it with other plant foods. I should say the formation of potentially carcinogenic compounds are reduced. Yeah, in research models where meat is digested alongside plants.
Wow. Yeah, so whoever first quoted variety as a spice of life, if he had a penny for every time that's true.
He'd be a rich man.
Yeah. Well, tell us, what's the meat factor?
Yeah, that's a good question. We don't really know exactly what they are. Probably one of those thousands of nutrients, or multiple, I should say. But there's some suggestion that it may be certain things like choline that could help with that. That there's other probably cofactors or metabolites within the meat that could that could help with the uptake. Exactly, it's not fully known. In milk, what is known is that one of the whey proteins, lactoferrin, the name kind of says it already, ferrin, can help with iron uptake. So there's been some compounds identified within animals or foods that can help with that, but it is not one fully known what those factors are.
I see. So as someone who's interested in human health, what do you either do for yourself or recommend for people that are low in iron?
Well,
or is that too generic?
I would recommend eating things like maybe liverwurst or blood sausage if you can stomach it. I quite enjoy it because I grew up in Europe, so I'm used to eating those things and I actually enjoy it. But usually organ meats, they're very rich in iron. So if you have low iron status, that could be a good place to start. Yeah, that would be my recommendation.
I love that from what I've been seeing and reading that regenerative practices create exponential return in nutritive differences. What have you seen in this?
In conventional farming systems, typically there's nitrogen applied and there's minerals that are applied to the fields. So we don't see a lot of difference in those, and that is partly by design, right, between regenerative and conventional. But if you kind of expand the nutritional profile beyond just protein and minerals, because foods contain thousands of nutrients.
Yes.
When you kind of look under the hood or peel back the onion layer, no pun intended, you see that there is a large difference that start to occur between conventional and regenerative. And particularly also when we look at crops and in animals as well, we see that those phytonutrients, those other probably 99% of the nutrients, those polyphenols, those flavonoids, the terpenes, the phenolics, those are actually not increased. Those are decreased. So, and there's actually work to suggest that when there's nitrogen application to a plant or when you have insecticides or pesticides, you actually decrease some of those compounds because the plant produces them in response to environmental factors. So the way to see it is that in regenerative agriculture, you create a tougher, more hardy plant. And the plant can't run away. So how does it become tougher and more hardy? By producing these phytochemicals. And these phytochemicals, actually, you can taste. They provide more flavor. If you have a carrot with more phytochemicals, it tastes more like a carrot, I think. And we can definitely also see that. Or if you have a blueberry that is richer in anthocyanidins, it has a stronger, deeper blueberry flavor than maybe a blueberry that is, yeah, quite literally more watery.
Have you ever looked into breeding practices in regards to the effect on the nutritive value at the end product?
Yep, we have, certainly. Like, do you mean plant breeding?
No, actually, I meant the cattle breeding.
Okay. Well, there is some effect. Maybe if you look at Wagyu, which is an animal that has a lot of intramuscular fat, you do see a phenotype that's slightly different, but it's very similar as it is in humans. Regardless of your ethnicity, the foods that you eat will have a far more dramatic impact on your health than any genetic background. And that's what we see in cattle as well. Whether you're one breed or the next breed, what you feed that breed will have a much more dramatic impact and kind of overrides certain nuances. I mean, certainly, of course, you have some animals that are maybe better adapted to be on a grain-based diet or have been selected for that. Maybe some animals that do better in certain environments because they're more heat tolerant or they're also more familiarity with the environment. We were, for instance, in doing some research on a farm in Alabama, and they had the Piney Woods, one with big horns. It's a Spanish heritage breed. And yeah, they were clearly more comfortable in that environment, and they knew that they could also consume the leaves of trees and things such as that, whereas maybe the Angus cattle were not as familiar with that. So you see some minute differences, but the diet of the animals is definitely by far the largest predictor. Actually, very interesting is that they learn from each other. So if you have animals that are grazing some of that, then eventually the other animal is likely to try it as well. So that was also one of the reasons why they had those Piney Wood breeds in there, because cattle would learn from them. Also, eventually interbreed, so that there's a little bit of the Piney Wood genetics, a little bit of that hardiness going into the Black Angus.
Yes, that's great. Yeah. Well, I heard Dr. Alan Williams bring up that researchers known as PIs, principal investigators, don't really go into the field or out onto the farm, but you do. Would you share an experience you've had that made you glad that you left the research lab and ventured out?
Yeah, for sure. I do spend a good time in my research lab, but in the summer we do field work. And how it's helpful is that you get firsthand insight into what farmers are doing, and you can also observe what the effect is of those practices. One thing that always was very eye-opening to me, and sometimes maybe results in a little bit of an internal battle, but not really, because it depends on how you look at the literature. But let's say one thing that is an interesting story is that whenever I visit farmers that practice rotational grazing or regenerative grazing, you can see that the lands look very healthy, the animals look very healthy, it has a beneficial impact on wildlife, the bird life is greater. So my own two eyes would tell me, okay, this is a good thing for the environment. If I then go back to my office and start reading a bunch of reports, then I can convince myself pretty quickly that what I just saw is the worst thing for the environment because of the greenhouse gas emissions, right? Because that's the one thing that often comes up, or that even for the biodiversity. So there's a risk of becoming disconnected from the work that you're actually doing or what you're actually studying if you don't go into the field as well. And the other part is I learn a lot from farmers, because farmers are doing things that is oftentimes ahead of the research, or maybe it hasn't been studied yet, right? But
right,
they empirically observe that this maybe works and that this has beneficial effects. For instance, one would be the biodiversity piece. Farmers observe, well, if I have like more grasses and more diversity, I see this is a beneficial effect for my animal. And then we study that and we're like, well, yes, indeed, you suspect you have an healthier animal and a more nutrient-dense piece of meat. And you're right about that. It's mainly just so I can stay connected and grounded to the work that we do.
Yes. I spoke with a person the other day and they brought up, which I'd never heard before, about the China study. And this is a study, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's a study that vegetarians just hold on to like it's gold or it's their rock, because it talks about meat and then it talks about why vegetarianism is the way to go. But in the China study, those meats were all grain fed.
Yes. So yes. And another issue with some of the studies, well, not issue, but one of the things is that people that eat more meat in general, or if you look at the populations, it tends to also be that they have other unhealthy behaviors as well, if that makes sense. Lower fruit and vegetable intake, other socioeconomic factors that can impact it, more smoking, drinking, gambling, those things, right? And when you co-vary for that more, it does seem that the effects of red meat and disease association become often quite neutral. And there's actually some interesting studies also from the Middle East that suggests that meat is more of a status symbol, that it actually is associated with improvements in health. So my point is there's important nuance to those things. But what is unfortunate is that meat tends to be eaten as part of more unhealthy diets. And then I would really be interested in seeing a study in the future. But again, it will have some other cofactors or covariates, I should say, covariates that impact this. But I think people that are probably likely to eat grass-fed beef and pastured eggs and pork and poultry are also likely to do a lot of other things that are good for their health. And I'll be very curious to see if in those populations, even though it currently makes up a minority, whether meat is still associated with metabolic disease. And this is another interesting thing also. In the randomized controlled trials, people are typically feeding red meat as part of a healthy diet, not as part of a standard American diet. So a lot of the randomized controlled trials indicate that when you eat red meat as part of a Mediterranean diet or some other whole foods diet, you actually see improvements in people's health compared to their baseline diet. So there's a little bit of a discrepancy between the two, where in epidemiological population-based studies, like the China study, but many other studies as well, you're studying people that are eating red meat as part of unhealthy diets, and in the randomized controlled trials, people are studying people that eat red meat as part of healthy diets.
And hence, there can be a huge difference, of course. Stefan, what is the most exciting research you've either done or are curious about?
That's a good question. I don't know if I have like one project that I point towards, but the most exciting part of the research, I think, is always when we interact with farmers and we do work that has direct applicability. That's probably some of the most exciting work. And one that I'm thinking of is that we did a big project called the Beef Nutrient Density Project. Farmers submitted samples to that, and that the information was usable for them because they could now have scientific evidence that what they were producing was more nutrient dense than maybe the commodity product. And they could immediately use that information. They could also use it to maybe improve on some things as well. So those type of studies are very rewarding because there seems to be an immediate use for that. Also, what I'm very excited about is a couple of years ago, we also started to move more into crops. We started to work on livestock, but over the last few years, we've been studying crops more as well. And that is also really exciting work, comparing how different production practices impact the nutrient density. And then, as I mentioned, these are oftentimes things that you can pick up on taste. One thing that I think our group and other groups are also doing, there is more interdisciplinary collaboration. And historically in academia, you may have like human nutrition scientists working on isolation. You have livestock scientists working in isolation, soil scientists that work in isolation. And we are trying to at least bring those communities together to look at those linkages across soil, plant, animal, and human health. You know, can we link these higher levels of phytonutrients to certain, maybe more microbial activity in the soil? But of course, I have no doubt that our knowledge will be a lot greater than it is today in 50 or 100 years from now.
Yeah, and it's so wonderful to see, obviously for you, but just for me to hear that the biologists and chemists and soil people are getting together. That's really a beautiful thing there. And that reminds me of a question I was thinking to ask you about animal health. Is there a way to go back, perhaps through bones of buffalo from a couple hundred years ago, and what a bone of a buffalo today is like, to look at some kind of nutrient density or strength of bone or something?
People do that, mainly looking at maybe a tissue that was frozen in the permafrost even, and look at the fatty acid composition of those. So people have definitely done that, and it does appear that those animals were very rich in omega-3s. Unfortunately, a lot of nutrients are not really as well preserved, if minerals certainly are, but in terms of like the omega-6 to 3 ratio, it does seem that we're able to get close to that or similar. And now granted, I know wild animals today are probably not 100% comparable with maybe some of the animals. Maybe the bison in Yellowstone are not the same as the bison that walked over 10,000 years ago. But you can certainly see within wild animals, I think it provides a good proxy of what is possible. Mm. And we do study wild game also within our labs. Sometimes people send it. Yeah. And from there on, I do think we kind of see what is possible, because you think of wild animals that can select from whatever they want. Granted, we have urbanization, so it's not like the animal can just go anywhere, but if it's in a national park or a mountain range, right, it's probably still has a good amount of that plant diversity.
Yes.
You do see that, these animals are quite quite nutrient dense, particularly when it comes to deer.
And then one last thing, Stefan, I always ask a rancher what their favorite cut of meat is, but now I'm curious, I want to know what your favorite chocolate is.
My favorite chocolate, yeah, it's a good question. I don't know if I have, per se, a favorite brand or anything, but I do like 100% dark chocolate for sure. So I just like the deep flavor of that. So that's usually what I buy. But I'm not sure if I'm enough of a connoisseur to say, well, I really like this chocolate that comes out of Uganda or anything like that.
Yeah.
I think as a Dutchman, we like dairy and we like cheese. And I must admit, in terms of that, we rephrase the questions of cheese. Some of the cheeses that I've had from the Pyrenees in France with the animals grazing mountain pastures, that is definitely the best cheese I've ever had. And if you look at that cheese, I mean, the French have studied that for phytonutrients, and it's really rich in these phytonutrients because we know that mountain pastures are typically amongst the most biodiverse pastures that are found in the world.
Mm, that's a great tip. Thank you so much. Jacob, tell us about how you got started in Roaring Fork Mill and what you focus on.
Absolutely. So we are the only regenerative organic certified flour mill in the state of Colorado. We stone mill up our flour, which keeps all the healthy germ and the bran and the endosperm intact. So it's a much healthier version of flour, a lot more nutritional density, and easier to digest, which is an important concept right now with how many people are
yes.
sensitive. But we got into this business, I say we, it's a completely family run business. There's five of us running the daily operations. So we got into this about 4 years ago, and I used to work up at Sterling College up in Northern Vermont, which is a really neat school. It's one of seven work colleges in the U.S. So everyone on campus has a job, and that's how they pay for their education. And it's based purely on sustainable agriculture. And there's two stone mill makers in the U.S. who actually make the equipment to stone mill flour. And again, stone milling is a unique form of flour milling. And we used to send students over there to learn about heritage grains, learn about stone milling.
Perfect.
And then when I moved to Carbondale, Colorado, which is where we're based, it's an agricultural community. And grain and potatoes are one of the first crops that were really cultivated there. However, most of those grain fields moved to alfalfa, which in Colorado is one of the most water-intensive crops you can grow. So we, as a family, you know, we were trying to figure out what would be the best crop to grow here that's climate resilient, that people would still want, that's a staple, that demand would be there for. And with my background with heritage grains, which again are a much healthier version, climate resilient style of grain, we realized the area we're in was actually a fantastic place to grow that. It needs cold nights and hot days, which is exactly what we have up there in the Mountain West in Carbondale. And then when we were starting testing out this concept, right, we got a small tabletop mill where bringing little bags of flour to restaurants and bakeries to see who would be interested. And very quickly, we realized the demand was a lot higher than what we can match, which is our small operation. So we started looking throughout the entire state of Colorado, not just our valley, for grain. And that's when we found the Colorado Grain Chain, which still is a fantastic connector throughout the entire state of growers, millers, maltsters, brewers, anyone working with grain. And they have a focus on heritage grain as well and organic grains. So that's a very quick overview of how we got started. And again, it's a family-run, family-operated business.
Well, you just sort of led me into my next question, which is about the milling stone. I remember speaking to Bob Quinn years ago, and he went off on this whole adventure telling us how he had to go to Europe, and then you found the right stone and all of this, and now
Absolutely. There
are places in the U.S.
Yeah,
which
it's
is
fantastic.
Great.
And the company we get our mill from is called New American Stone Mills. And the reason that they can really exist up in northern Vermont is because it's made with granite. There's a lot of granite up in northern Vermont. They started out as a small bakery. They said, we want to mill our own flour. And he started making his own mills and then started bringing it on the commercial level. But stone milling is an amazing form of making flour, right? I say all the time when I'm talking to people, if you know of a friend who's gluten sensitive, they go to Europe, they can have a loaf of bread and they feel okay. It's mainly the way flour is processed here in the U.S. that makes us not be able to digest it. So stone milling keeps all the healthy oils, the germ and the bran and the endosperm intact. And all those components, when it's intact in a flour, helps us actually digest the flour. So it's not only the way flour is milled, but it's also the grain you use. So we focus on heritage grains, and heritage grains and ancient grains are older varietals of grain that have been around from anywhere, you know, from 6,000 to 10,000 years. Einkorn is the oldest grain known. It dates back 10,000 years. And these styles of grain have deeper root systems. They can pull in more nutrients from the ground, taller stalks, and again, a lot more flavor to them. But they're easier to digest, which is a big component of, again, why so many people are developing these gluten sensitivities. It's the style of grain that's used and what's sprayed on the grain. A lot of grain has glyphosate sprayed on it. It's overprocessed and enriched and bleached, and all those factors make us not be able to digest flour, right? It's not necessarily gluten. There's good, healthy gluten, which is our style of flour making. It's heritage grains and stone milling that.
Yes. And using the stone grist milling method, as you mentioned, it's time proven. The benefits are there. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting to hear you relate it to nutrient density. Mm-hmm. So the end product obviously has that nutrient density. And of course, when anyone has their livestock out in a field, the more biodiversity that there is in the field, the better and more nutritious the meat is. And I'm wondering, when you're sourcing your grain, do you look into that? How do people play with that biodiversity when they're growing a grain?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's one of the reasons that we focused on moving forward only with regenerative organic certified grain, because that's a level above organic certification. It means you're not only, you know, not spraying things on your land, treating your land well, but you're rebuilding soil, right? Soil is life. With topsoil means we can continue growing on farms for future generations. We aren't overusing nutrients in the soil. So we are moving forward. We should, in the next 2 to 3 weeks, be launching 7 lines of flour that are all regenerative organic certified. We'll be the only flour mill in the country that only has regenerative organic certified grain and flour. Because, yeah, it's exactly what you just said, right? It makes for a healthier, full system, full life cycle farm.
Yeah, and that's the key. I was actually at the meeting in Denver when they had their organic certification come out. It was so newsworthy and governmental and everything, and the regen thing isn't governmental, which is a good thing, I think.
Yeah, but you never know.
but with that, it was the buzz, you know, and everybody that cared about the land, we're going to go organic. But you can go to any farmer's market and buy organic produce, and it may not be any more healthy than the King's Supers or Safeway version, right?
Yeah, it's been watered down.
So it's interesting now for me to be watching the regen thing happen. What's your feeling about that with the regen certification? Yes, it's going to be better than the store-bought flour that was processed up the wazoo. So what do you look at when you see a farm or decide, okay, we're going to work with these people because?
Yeah, well, first, any farm that is going down the path of regenerative, I want to go give them a big hug, right? Because it's vitally important work.
Yes, right? Absolutely.
Especially in a state where we don't have very much water, right? Regenerative practices use less water. I don't have the exact stat, but it's significant.
Yes, that's a beautiful point for sure.
I do think it's a challenge and something we've focused on with the help of the Colorado Grain Chain, actually, of creating educational marketing campaigns around what regenerative is. I would say the large portion of people walking down an aisle, if they see that regenerative organic certified label and logo on our bags, they have no idea what it means. Right. And it's hard for us because we're in that world every day where a lot of people know about it.
Right.
But, you know, we're a very small percentage of people who are focused on regenerative farming practices.
Definitely.
So it's really important for not just us as a company, not just us as Roaring Fork Mill, but every farm and brand and individual that does believe in this to continue talking about it, right? And figuring out ways to educate consumers, educate the media too. There's a lot of folks who are asking questions about it, who want to learn about it, because we're realizing, right, we're getting momentum around it. I mean, people are starting to realize that they're having health issues based on what they eat. Gluten, for example.
So many farmers and ranchers have decided to go into it because of their family's health.
Yeah, exactly.
It was the catalyst.
And I feel like a lot of people start brands because of that as well. You know, they say, wow, I haven't been able to eat this for 10 years and I went to Europe, I can have it. Why? What's the problem here? So
they create their brand.
So, yeah, vitally important, but we do need to educate people around what regenerative organic farming is.
Yeah, and there's a headline that continuously floats across the about page on your website, and it reads, learn the process. Share one or two things that are based basic in grain production that either surprised you initially or that might be unknown to the consumer?
That's a good question. One, I didn't realize how much byproduct there was. So when we first started milling, we just milled whole wheat flour. You know, there was one option. We had a mill, and the only spout for flour to come out was 100% whole wheat, which is great. It's still the majority of our sales. Again, the healthiest version of flour you can get. It has all the germ and the bran in it. But once we got a bigger mill, and we started working with a lot more bakeries and restaurants that wanted a sifted flour, there's a lot of byproduct that's called middlings. And that's really like the most nutrient dense aspect of the flour, because it's all the germ and the bran, right, extracted out. And when you look at it and you feel it, it almost feels like sand a little bit. And you realize why it's easier to use a flour that's sifted, because those are like little razor blades, right? Mm-hmm. It means your flour is not going to rise as much because all that germ and bran is slicing through the bubbles while it's rising. But one of the really neat things we learned to do with it is find partners in our valley that want to use it for their cattle.
Right.
And our property actually abuts a cattle ranch called Milagro Ranch that has regenerative organic certified beef. And it's really hard for him to find inputs for his cattle that's regenerative certified. But since our flour is regenerative certified, you know, I can just call him up and say, hey, I have 10 bags of middlings. You want to drive down and get it? And he'll bring me some, you know, ground beef and we'll trade it. And it's actually been a really nice system in our community for people who want to go more regenerative with cattle or sheep or whatever it might be. And
right.
We have a really nutrient dense input for them now. But I did not realize how much, because sometimes it's 20-25% of what we're milling, depending on how fine we're milling is, you know, not actually going to flour bag.
Yeah, amazing. As you mentioned earlier, and thanks to Audrey Paw from Colorado Grain Chain, tell us about the nonprofit Colorado Grain Chain a little more. And you mentioned the community is there, mm-hmm. and it holds quite a spirit, which the Regen family mm-hmm. is all about. Why are you specifically involved in that?
Yeah, well, they do fantastic work. And when we were first growing, we grow a lot of grain in the Roaring Fork Valley. I mean, it's wonderful to have that close system where we can give flour to our bakers and restaurants and consumers that's grown 10 miles down the road. But as we're growing as a business, we need to expand out of the Roaring Fork Valley. And I didn't know the first place to go to look for grain. And I was like, do I drive around and talk to farmers? And then I was Googling grain in Colorado, and the Colorado Grain Chain came up. One, they're just lovely folks, right? They're really nice people to work with. They give a lot of wonderful advice, but they also connect us. Farms have a hard time existing if nobody's buying their product. And we have a hard time existing if there's not enough farms growing heritage grains. And we all needed each other. We needed somebody to put us in touch. So the Colorado Grain Chain not only does that, but they bring us together for convenings. They bring us together to conferences. They help support us. They have micro grants.
Right. We'll get to that next.
Yeah. That have really benefited us. They're a sounding board. You know, when we have ideas, we can run it by them. We just were at our first big trade show, Newtopia Now, and I actually unfortunately couldn't make it, and Audrey stepped in to work our booth. So it's a close-knit environment, and there's only really, when it comes down to us, a few of us focused on climate resilient grains in the state. But if we come together as one voice, we're much more powerful.
Absolutely.
And we can make a bigger difference.
Yeah. Well, tell us about the micro grant that you were a recipient last year.
Yeah. Yes.
And what did you do with the grant?
So it was their first year of having this micro grant. They have another one open right now that is probably closing any day.
Right.
But ours was for, as I mentioned earlier, creating an educational campaign around heritage grains and what's happening in the state of Colorado with them. So we talked about the benefits of a stone milled flour versus a roller milled flour. We've talked about the benefits of a heritage grain versus a genetically modified modern wheat varietal and where those differences occur. And we posted most of that on social media, which was really helpful actually for us to grow a bigger consumer base, because we hadn't focused much on that. We hadn't spent time or resources on it. But putting out these educational videos, people want that information, right? People know there's something wrong with what they're eating and they're not really sure why they don't feel good.
Right.
They've heard that there are certain ingredients that they can digest, right? They've heard about flour in Europe. So really finding a avenue to get that out into the world is what they're helping us and supporting us to do.
Yeah.
It's been really beneficial. We've gained a lot of information around what we're doing at Roaring Fork Mill and grain in Colorado as a whole.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. People are hungry for that knowledge, and it's hard to necessarily find accurate information. You know, and it's hard to sift through all the information we see every single day.
Yeah.
Colorado Grain Chain helped us put together accurate information around this and get it out to the consumer in a digestible manner.
Yeah. So, Jacob, how are you seeing awareness and growth in Colorado and also nationally? I know you've got your finger on the pulse nationwide and probably internationally. I know there are some other alternative grain networks, not unlike the Colorado grain chain, that are kind of springing up all over the place. So mentioning that, oh, wait, we could be selling more wheat if we had it. How is this whole market thing looking to you right now?
It's a really good question. And I think we're teetering on the edge of tipping into larger consumer demand. In the state of Colorado specifically, you know, when we started 3.5 years ago, we were in one or two stores in our valley, and it was primarily just because we were a local company. that was all. Yes. Like, oh, you're a local company. All right, we'll put you in the store.
Nice,
cool.
Yeah.
But now we're in about 35 specialty stores throughout the state. We're getting interest from larger retailers on the West Coast and the Central region and the East Coast because there is now interest nationally in finding a healthy flour alternative. And a lot of that was gluten-free flour. Right. A lot of people, every time I'm at the farmer's market, anytime I'm tabling anywhere, they come and say, oh, are you gluten free? And I say, no, but let me tell you about our style of gluten. So there's interest nationally from people, from consumers. Right. And consumer demand drives everything. Right. If you can get consumers to be interested in your product, you can grow more acreage using climate resilient grains. You can have more acres that go towards regenerative organic certifications. So interest is there now. The challenging part and the part where we're ready to kind of step up to the plate is if there's not a product there, but consumer demand is there, it doesn't mean anything.
Right.
We've now tried to build up a product that is consumer facing, that tells a story about heritage grains, tells a story about regenerative organic certifications and regenerative organic farming practices. Now we have to try to scale to that. Right. We focus just on Colorado. We're starting to get interest there. But when you want to start working with bigger retailers, right, and the interest is there from the retailers now, the regenerative organic certification label is actually the fastest year over year growing label, clean food label. It's growing at 30% year over year rate, which is really
amazing.
High, right? The next highest one is the organic certification, which I think is about 18% right now, which is still significant. But
right.
But, you know, 30% means something.
Yeah. I mean, today, if you're going organic, you've got to go regenerative.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're going to be left in the dust,
for sure.
I would think.
Yeah. So the interest is there. And now we have to figure out how to get our products there. And one unique thing that we're doing, right, is our goal is to incentivize farmers to grow more acreage around climate resilient rock certified grains. But there's only a certain subsect of people who want to buy a bag of flour. And I recognize that. So we're starting to create other value added products with our flour.
Like
shortbread cookies. We're bringing the first regenerative organic certified shortbread cookie to market. We should be launching in about 3 weeks now. We also have a line of graham crackers. We have lines of pancake mixes that we've done research and development over the last about year and a half. So we've been developing these products for the market to be ready for them.
Right.
And now the market's ready. And now it's our responsibility to get it out into the world to drive more demand for these things so that we can support farmers.
Wonderful. Wow, that's very exciting. But it just keeps growing, and I can see why your interest just keeps growing
well. Keep an eye out, because hopefully they'll start getting on shelves. You know, it's really, we've learned so much about how challenging it is to get on retail shelves. When you start working with distributors, when you start working with retailers, it's hard to make any money doing it.
Right. You want to be on the end cap and
It's challenging.
It is, yes.
But worth it.
Yeah. All the little details you have no idea about until you start down the path.
Yeah. It's always funny. I tell folks who are interested in starting food business, like, if you know what actually really goes into it, most people wouldn't want to start a business. But also part of the fun thing is you learn something new every day.
Yes.
You know, it's just all part of the process.
Right. Well, I ask my livestock ranchers what their favorite cut of meat is. What's your favorite bread? Do you have a favorite grain that it's made out of? Or
I love just a traditional sourdough loaf. I really do. I also really like cinnamon raisin bread. It's almost like guilty. Cinnamon raisin French toast in the morning.
Oh my God.
I also have pancakes for every single meal. But bread, just a traditional sourdough loaf made with Rouge de Bordeaux and White Sonora. We have an excellent baker named Gabby out of Tiny Pine in Carbondale, and she uses our Rouge de Bordeaux, which we grow 10 miles down the road in Old Snowmass, and she mixes that with White Sonora, and it's just delicious right out of the oven.
Wonderful. Well, Jacob, is there anything in closing that you'd like to share with us?
We appreciate the continued interest. You know, anytime somebody asks a question about this, means more people are learning about it, and that's one of the most important things, is how we can continue spreading the word. There's a lot of awesome agriculture in Colorado, and Colorado is now one of the states leading the movement in heritage grains and climate resilient grains. And that's really valuable because this state needs crops that are climate resilient, that use less water, but that directly go into the food system. Mm-hmm. Right. So kudos to Colorado Grain Chain for pushing that movement
absolutely
forward.
Yeah. And for you joining the ranks. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you for asking. We appreciate it.
Thanks to Stefan Van Vliet and Jacob Trumbull. We are at cultivatedaudio.com to see more of what we're about, and our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being here and for helping make here where we all want to be.